Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
Good morning and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, always speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, talking to you from wet and rainy St. Louis today. It is really raining outside. Gutters are overflowing. Streets are kind of flooding. But thinking about weather and speaking about weather, if you're vacationing in Hawaii, well, you got to brace yourself for possibly two hurricanes. Now, I'm sitting here thinking, there are people that plan, you know, to go to places like Hawaii, get away, have a great time and a great vacation, but it's always best to plan a little bit before the hurricane season. So really thinking about the Hawaiians today, they're bracing for some major storm and hoping and praying everything will be well for everyone over there. Have a very special program today. Have a guest that I'm really, really looking forward to talking to, and she is an expert on Iranian history, on really the nuts and bolts of the Iranian regime. She's a consultant to many of the foreign affairs departments. She's been on CNN, Fox News, and I'm speaking of Banafshe Zan. She will be my guest in the next half an hour. She really is an expert on the happenings of the Iranian regime. She's going to speak about the history of the Iranian regime, terrorism, the nuclear situation, and she's really someone that has been everywhere, even actually helping with intelligence, consulting those in the United States Congress and the Senate. So I'm really looking forward to tapping into her wealth of knowledge today on the cross in the desert. Well, the situation in Israel is a ceasefire if Hamas will abide by the rules, a 72-hour ceasefire. And so there is such turmoil there. And like I've been talking to you on this program several times, Hamas continues to show the world how terroristic they really are. It's a war crime what they're doing to the citizens there, the Gazans, putting them out in harm's way, launching missiles in residential areas, pushing their citizens towards the areas that they know Israel will strike at. They are the real war crime people, not Israel, as the United Nations likes to bandy about that term, accusing Israel of that. Speaking of Israel and Iran, I want to do something before Banafshe comes on. I want to show you just the rhetoric and the things that the Supreme Leader has said about Israel over the past year or so. And instead of reading you the statements, I want to play for you several sound bites, several clips of what the Iranian government thinks of Israel from the lips of the Supreme Leader. And I think the best way to put this into context is to let you hear for yourself what he has said about Israel. So we're going to play several of those back to back, and I want you to hear what the Iranian government thinks of Israel right now on the cross in the desert.
As Muslims mark the end of Ramadan, the plight of those trapped in Gaza is the main focus of attention. As Iranians celebrated the feast of Eid al-Fitr, the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, addressed crowds in Tehran and criticized Israeli aggression against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. It's a genocide committed by the Zionist regime. It's a catastrophe of history. Those who support the people responsible for these crimes must be condemned. The whole world, above all the Islamic world, must arm the Palestinians. Meanwhile, Hamas leader Khalid Mishal, speaking in Doha, said that Hamas had nothing to do with the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers that sparked the latest cycle of Israeli-Palestinian violence. He said Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu jumped to conclusions in order to justify his aggression against the Palestinians.
Coming a day after Iran's supreme leader delivered a savage public attack on Israel, calling the Jewish state an unclean, rabid dog, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has taken his vitriolic rhetoric to social media and tweeted the very same message. Khamenei posted a picture on his Twitter account which reads, "Israel is the sinister, unclean, rabid dog of the region," which apparently shows IDF soldiers on patrol next to a security dog that is biting the arm of an unknown person. It appears Iran's supreme leader is preying on the perception some Muslims have that dogs are dirty animals that should be avoided to inspire hatred towards Israel. The comments have already been rebuked by France and come at a time when world powers are meeting with Iran in Geneva to work out a deal regarding the Islamic Republic's controversial nuclear program.
Strong words from Iran's leader. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, threatened on Thursday to destroy the Israeli cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel were to launch a military attack against Iran.
At times, the officials of the Zionist regime threaten to launch a military invasion, but they themselves know that if they make the slightest mistake, the Islamic Republic will raise Tel Aviv and Haifa to the ground.
Khamenei's address was broadcast live on state television and heard in Jerusalem, where U.S. President Barack Obama delivered a message to the Israeli people during his three-day visit to the region.
And I've made the position of the United States of America clear. Iran must not get a nuclear weapon. This is not a danger that can be contained. And as president, I've said all options are on the table for achieving our objectives. America will do what we must to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran.
Israel has threatened military action against Iran unless Tehran abandons its nuclear activities. Western powers suspect Iran's program is intended to develop nuclear weapons, but Tehran denies those allegations.
Well, you have some examples right there, and there are more coming. And I wanted to jump off on the last example with President Obama. He's preparing to go on vacation, but if you will listen to him in his public addresses, he seems so disengaged about what's happening in this chaotic world. With Russia threatening to put boots on the ground in the Ukraine, and the situation with Hamas and Israel, and of course ISIS, our president doesn't seem to be connected emotionally and is more interested in the golf club than foreign affairs. And this is sad when we need someone to address the world powers and to speak directly to what they are doing. Our president is more interested in vacationing. And so I wanted to point that out because I'm listening to these rhetorical statements by the supreme leader, and it once again reminds me of what's happening in the world today. We are sitting down with Iran, giving them a four-month extension. The supreme leader calls for the destruction of Israel, and yet we're willing to negotiate with them. And all the things that we're talking about, we still have an American citizen, Saeed Abedini, languishing in a prison in Iran. And these are issues that won't go away, that must be confronted, and it's very, very sad. I want to continue showing you and demonstrate to you what the Iranian Supreme Leader is saying about Israel. We're going to hear a few more examples right now on the cross.
Now pushing for stronger sanctions against their own country, claiming it's the epicenter of terrorism in the Middle East. They say it's part of a strategy by Tehran to expand in that region. Eric Shawn's in our newsroom. So, Eric, what is Tehran saying exactly?
Yeah, Martha, there are harsh words from Iran on the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Tehran again calling for Israel's destruction and demanding the West Bank now join Hamas in launching its own missile attacks. And the controversial demands come from this man, Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. In a sermon, he called Israel a rabid dog and says the Islamic world should arm itself against the Jewish state. Iranian officials say they are working with the Hamas leadership and supporting the terror group's goals. Khamenei's comments come as a coalition of 30 Iranian opposition groups have gathered on Capitol Hill. They've called on Washington to ramp up sanctions against the Iranian regime. The group, the Iranian Democracy Front, accuses Tehran of continuing to support terrorism and says the Obama administration needs to throw its support behind the Iranian opposition.
American administration has put all their eggs in the government's basket. They are totally ignoring every opposition group's supporter of democracy. And they are, I think, missing a big opportunity to at least have a dialogue with those who are against the regime and could be alternative to it.
Well, a variety of opposition groups are, of course, working against the regime in Tehran, Arthur.
So what does the administration say about that, Eric?
Well, the State Department told Fox News that it is not aware of any plans to recognize the opposition groups. This, of course, comes as the administration continues to negotiate with Tehran on those nuclear talks that now face a fall deadline. But those groups warn that the talks have only strengthened the regime, and the opposition groups say the only answer to stop a possible Iranian nuclear bomb is regime change. Tehran, though, has always claimed it only wants nuclear capability for electricity and medical purposes. Martha?
Indeed they have. Eric, thank you very much.
Once again, illustrating just what the Iranian regime wants to do. I want to go back to the Middle East for just a second. I want to bring to your attention something that really troubles my soul. Hamas has fired nearly 3,500 rockets at Israeli civilians. It fired 600 rockets from schools and other civilian areas. It used, quote, humanitarian aid intended for schools to build secret terror tunnels to invade Israel. Israel has responded simply in self-defense. Israel has decimated Hamas terrorists and destroyed 32 terror tunnels. Now, in light of that, the Obama administration wants to give millions of our taxpayer dollars to rebuild Hamas. Hamas is a recognized terrorist organization. Its goal is to destroy Israel. New aid will only be used to subsidize terror. And really, the American Center for Law and Justice is circulating a petition saying we cannot allow this to happen. And Jay actually says that he spent last month abroad defending Israel's right to defend itself. And he says, we're on Capitol Hill working to stop new funding for terrorists. So there's going to be a petition I'm going to put up on my page where you can speak directly to this situation that our tax dollars should not go there because Hamas will use it for more terrorist situations. It's something that we need to speak out against. Well, I have a couple of more examples of the attitude of the Iranian regime, its supreme leader, against Israel. We're going to hear that right now on the cross in the desert. These are several sound bites from a few years ago when Ahmadinejad made the famous disputed claim that we need to wipe Israel off the map. I want you to hear these several sound bites right now on the cross in the desert.
This comment just came in. The president of Iran just said, just a short time ago where you are there, said that the Zionist regime will soon be wiped out.
President Ahmadinejad's speech earlier this week saying that a new wave of Palestinian attacks would wipe Israel off the face of the earth.
The Iranians are trying to not just mock, but deny a Holocaust while simultaneously preparing to launch another. The president of Iran is talking about genocide, wiping Israel and, frankly, the United States off the map.
As a Jew, I feel much more threatened by people like Jimmy Carter when yeah. Israel is facing genocidal enemies who have sworn to destroy it and kill the Jews.
Now, let's look at the map and to see what he's talking about. Here is Israel
in the middle.
The current president of Iran has announced that the destruction of Israel is an important part of their agenda.
I spoke to Mark Regev from the Israeli Foreign Ministry in Jerusalem. Does he agree with Benjamin Netanyahu, I asked, that Ahmadinejad is the worst tyrant since Hitler and Israel's greatest enemy?
We got common goals that make sense for both our peoples. Two such goals Iran convincing the Iranians to get rid of its nuclear weapons.
I'd love to think there's something to negotiate with Iran about, but you have a president there who his sworn aim is to wipe Israel off the face of the map and kill every Jew in the Middle East.
There is going to be this armada of essentially these Muslim nations joined with Russia to invade Israel, it says, in the latter days.
Ahmadinejad is the new Hitler. Too many Americans, and particularly on the left, don't see that. They don't see the threat. Ahmadinejad is saying to people in Iran that the end of the world is rapidly approaching and that it's his mission to bring it about by destroying Israel.
Another one said, I want to destroy the Jews of the world. And another one said, only when no Jews are living, the world will be better. We know that the Shoah came. Take Ahmadinejad very seriously.
Israel might be wiped off the map.
And he stands up, he says Israel should be wiped off the map.
Wiped off the map.
Eliminate Israel from the face of the earth.
Wiped off the map.
Wipe Israel off the map.
Wiped off the map.
Wiped off the map.
Destruction of Israel.
Israel should be wiped off the map.
Are we going to have to wait until there's a mushroom cloud over Jerusalem?
That's the situation described by the prophet Ezekiel. You ought to read your Bibles.
Nearly half of the U.S. believes we will eventually have to take military action against Iran, according to our new Fox poll.
And there you heard some examples about the remark, the public outcry Ahmadinejad made against Israel, saying that the Jews need to be wiped off the face of the map. And, of course, there's been so many gymnastics used by the Iranians to try to substantiate that he was misquoted, the kind of Farsi he used was weak, this is not what he intended to say, and on it goes. But when you take his statement buttressed up against what the Supreme Leader is currently saying and teaching, then you know that this is not a matter of a misquote. This is not a matter of something being taken out of context. This is the attitude the Iranian regime has against Israel. And, of course, one of the reasons why they want the right to have a nuclear weaponry is not just Israel, but they would like to aim those missiles also toward us. And my guest, Barak Shazan, is going to talk a little bit about a video that she produced a couple of years ago called Set the Red Line. It talks about the nuclear situation. It talks about Iran, and we're going to ask her some questions about that very, very immensely popular video. Over 1 million hits on that. It's gone viral in the last couple of years. It's very well produced, and we're going to talk to Banafshay about that. But you want to understand something else about the context of Ahmadinejad's remarks from a few years ago. There is a peculiar teaching among the Shia Muslims, especially the Shiite brands, because those that live in Iran are not the Sunnis. They're not the majority. They're the minority, the Shias. And according to the Shia, and of course they consign their beliefs against a system of the 12 imams. According to them, there is a legend that the 12th imam, the Mahdi, will return prior to the return of Christ, according to Islam, and that he will bring peace and righteousness and justice, but basically the 12th imam, the return of the Mahdi, is to convert the entire world to Islam. And so when Ahmadinejad makes these remarks, as he did, the former president, he was talking much about the return of the Mahdi, this Islamic Messiah, if you will return and prepare the world for the worldwide domination of Islam. And so this is why he was so obsessed with these public outcries against Israel. He's basically giving them a warning, and it's in the context of the Shia belief of the return of the 12th Imam, that is, the Mahdi. So I wanted to give you a little context for those remarks that he made. Right now, I want to shift gears just a little bit. I want to go back to the Israeli-Hamas situation, and we're going to hear from a particular person that I think is very, very insightful. Mohab Youssef is the son of Hamas, the founder of the Hamas. And a few years ago, he wrote a book called Son of Hamas. He became a Christian and is speaking out against the terrorism of Hamas. And just recently, he was on Fox News with Megyn Kelly on The Kelly File, and we're going to hear that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
John Kerry invested an enormous amount of time. In the end, it's up to the two parties to make a decision. We can lead them to resolve some of the technical issues and to show them a path, but they've got to want it.
That was President Obama earlier today suggesting there's only so much America can do to broker a peace between Israel and Hamas. Our next guest is the son of one of the founders of Hamas and says a lasting peace will never be possible. His father, a leader of the terror group, was arrested earlier this summer in connection with the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers. That crime is believed to have sparked the deadly conflict between Israel and Hamas nearly, well, years ago. When the world began to see images like these emerge of the child victims in this fight, Mossab Hassan Youssef felt compelled to speak out in the hopes of shedding light on Hamas ideology. Mossab Hassan Youssef is the son of Hamas founder Sheikh Hassan Youssef, and he's also the author of Son of Hamas. He is featured in the documentary The Green Prince. Mossab, good to see you tonight. Thank you so much for being here. So let's start with this. Why do you believe that a lasting peace is never going to happen?
Well, peace between Israel and Hamas is not going to happen because Israel is a democracy. Hamas is a terrorist organization. It's an ideological organization. Is there a possibility for peace between Israel and Palestinians? That's possible, but not between Israel and Hamas.
What your father co-founds what our State Department says is a terror group, what you say is a terror group. How were you brought up in it? How did they begin to try to indoctrinate you?
Well, when I was a child, the first Palestinian Intifada started. And we witnessed violence and many people were dying and we hated Israel. Then the second Palestinian Intifada came and waves of suicide bombing attacks and we blamed Israel. And I used to think that Israel is the enemy, not knowing how my father and his organization was only a tool in the hands of some regional powers, that they move Hamas and encourage them to kill and fight against Israel for just political gain. And at some point, I got really tired of this game, and I chose to... different path for my life.
When you see these images that we are seeing now of these Palestinian children looking scared, hurt, confused, and I asked the current Israeli ambassador to the United States last night in the program about the fear that Israel, in fighting this battle, may be stoking the next generation of hate. Do you see that as a real risk, and how do we stop that from happening?
Well, it's a risk, and I think there's going to be more generations to hate Israel, and unfortunately Israel has no choice but to defend itself. Now, the only way, I believe, to fight an organization like Hamas is to unmask them by exposing their ideology, what they stand for. Hamas is not a political party. It's not even a Palestinian organization. Hamas hijacked what's so-called the Palestinian cause and infiltrated the society to push their religious ideological agendas. Now, I would like to remind the Palestinian people what Hamas did to their rival party, Fatah, in Gaza when Hamas took over a few years ago. They killed Fatah the same way that they're killing the Israeli soldiers today. Hamas does not care for the lives of Palestinians. Don't think for a second, please, that Hamas cares for the children's blood. They want the children of Gaza to die. This is what gives them Arab and Islamic world sympathy, and this is what will condemn Israel internationally. This is their game, and they're happy about it.
When I hear you talking about them, and this is, you know, we've heard some of this before, I wonder how you think we, the United States and our president, are handling this. You know, when you hear the president, he condemns Hamas's tactics, but then he also has harsh words for Israel on the civilian casualties.
Yes. Well, what I would like to see from the president of the United States of America, not to be a mediator here in this situation.
Right.
You know, Israel is a democracy. You know, and since Socrates and Plato, democracies don't negotiate with terrorists or terrorist organizations. As long as Hamas continues and insists to be a terrorist organization, using force to push their political and religious agendas, I think all democracies have to unify to fight this type of organization. If we fail in fighting Hamas, tomorrow there will be 100 Hamas, and they will take advantage of our division and disagreement.
Is there too much equivocating going on, or I mean, is the president right to be calling out the civilian casualties?
Well, again, what I would like to see from the president of the supreme power in this world, not to take sides, not even to try to be balanced. He comes off balance, you know, and he tried to come as a mediator in this situation. He needs to stand by Israel, not because Israel stands for all the American values and the free world values alone, because Hamas is the enemy of the United States of America. Hamas is the enemy of the free world. And what Israel is doing today in the region mm-hmm. is fighting on behalf of all the free people in this Western civilization.
Wow. Mousab, you're a very brave young man. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Some insightful words from a man who knows quite well what he's speaking about. His father, the founder of Hamas, and he understands the mindset of terrorism, and he wrote a book not just unmasking Hamas, but also talking about his Christian faith. And he found that in Christianity, he discovered the God of love. You see, there is the God of hate in the Islamic theology, the God that predestines evil, the God that is far and distant. But in Christianity, you have the God of intimate relationship, the God of love. And Mousab Youssef discovered that God, and he has been a devout Christian, as well as one speaking out against terrorism. And so our thoughts and prayers are with Mousab at this time, a very dangerous time to live. And I've heard him in other interviews that he's not afraid. He wants to speak his mind and take his message to the world, and he's doing just that. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Banafshe Zand, and she's going to be our guest here on The Cross in the Desert. But before she comes on, I just wanted to talk to you intimately for just a couple of minutes. When you hear about the chaos and the unrest, the violence, the bloodshed in the world, what is your place of refuge? How do you deal with that emotionally? On the last Cross in the Desert, I began to talk to you about what the Psalms talk about in those times of chaos, those poetic words of inspiration that David wrote in the Psalms that comfort us in those chaotic moments. And if you're a Christian, you can find refuge and solace and peace in God. And I began a teaching which I feel like I want to continue, because I realize when I play these interviews and these examples of what's going on in the world, that sometimes we just want to turn it off. We just want to go run and hide and say, I can't deal with this anymore. This is too overwhelming. And, you know, I want to identify with you, too. Sometimes I want to turn off the television, the remote. I want to turn off the cell phone, the computer, because sometimes it becomes more than I can bear and understand. And my heart is with the chaos in the world, the people that are enduring it. When you see the images on the news, the innocent children and women that are suffering because of this conflict, it breaks your heart. It's hard to watch. And so for me, as a Christian, I find refuge and solace in the Lord. In fact, Psalm 46, David says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. You see, he identified that God is not some distant, faraway, unconcerned deity, but that he says he is a very present in trouble. God is our help. He's not detached like the deist God who just created and walked away, that he is intimately involved. And you say, well, when you see the chaos and the suffering, why is it that God does not intervene? Well, part of the reason is his word says that he wills that none perish, but that all come to repentance. So he's working out his plan in the midst of the evil and suffering. Our free choice is involved. Sin is in the world because our first parents made a choice. And we make choices, and there are consequences. And so God is our refuge, and God is our strength. He's a very present help in trouble. I see that our guest has arrived, and I want to introduce her before I bring her on, The Cross in the Desert. Banafshe Zand is an expert on Iranian history and terrorism, as well as a consultant to foreign affairs departments. She was also editor of Iran Press News and has contributed to publications like the National Review. Banafshe has appeared on Fox News, CNN, and Voice of America, and I want to welcome her right now to The Cross in the Desert.
Thank you, Randy. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm delighted to be able to assist in trying to demystify the nightmare that we Iranians have endured for the last 36 years, unfortunately.
Yes, and you said it right, the last 36 years, because I really want to take our audience back to the beginnings of the time during the Shah and how this all developed into the Iranian regime. And Banafshe, am I saying your name correctly?
It's actually Banafshe.
Okay, Banafshe.
There you go.
I knew I was going to get it right. Banafshe. Thank you. I stumble over my Persian words yet. You know, I talk to my Iranian friends a lot, and when I start speaking Farsi, they kind of laugh at me because my pronunciations are wrong. And so I thank you for your patience. But
the fact that you make an effort is absolutely wonderful and brilliant. It's much appreciated.
Oh, well, thank you, dear. Thank you so much. You have quite a history. I'm reading about your knowledge on the Iranian regime, on history, and I'm just fascinated by your commitment to putting this in perspective with what's going on in the Middle East, with what's going on in the Iranian regime, why they treat their people this way. But there's a history to your life, and please illuminate us to your background and to how you came to where you are today. Tell us about living in Iran, and tell us how you came to who you are today.
Well, you know, I have, in terms of my parents' work and my family background, I come from a family that's been in the business of not necessarily politics, but in sort of politics, sort of social development, if you will. For what we know of, at least for about 15 generations. Both my parents come from the same family, so it's if you look at it as a kind of a clan, the way perhaps, let's say, the Scots would have done. If you look at them as a clan, they're the same clan, and they're just sort of two different ends of the same clan. And one side of the clan, my mother's side, basically went into the sort of justice and law and legal issues, and my father's side went into the military and philosophy part of it. My father was a journalist. He was considered the Václav Havel of Iran. He stayed behind in Iran after the revolution began because he felt that the mullahs would really destroy the country. He was one of those people who was, who respected people of faith, but he believed that faith is something extremely private, and that the moment that it becomes a sort of a collectivist thing, it could lead to areas that infringes on people's, you know, on civil rights and on human rights.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed behind to basically, let's say, monitor, for the lack of a better word, the cultural and socio socio-historical development or flow of this regime. And of course he was right because, you know, Iran has been struggling with the power grabbing of the mullahs for the better part of 400 years, and specifically even the last 130 years where the mullahs have done everything they possibly could to manipulate and damage and power grab and embezzle and everything you can possibly imagine that one hopes would not be something that people of faith would do. But really, the thing is that, you know, there's faith and then there's religionism. And by religionism, I mean being in the business of religion mongering versus the spirituality and the human connection to God. So the thing is that as he monitored this and as he continued to confront the Khomeinists with their summary executions of Iranians, the destruction of Iranian culture, the social, you know, the social development. I mean, Iran was a very vibrant, very cultured, and slowly but surely becoming before the revolution an international presence. It was a gorgeous country. The poor were beginning to get educated. They had access to all kinds of free education, free healthcare. It was an equal opportunity country. I mean, if you worked hard, you got somewhere. There wasn't a caste system like you would see in Arab countries or places like India, for example. So when my father realized that the mullahs, in fact, have lied, as he expected, about all of these things that they promised when they overthrew the Shah, he began to basically, slowly but surely, in various ways, exposing it. And so the regime had arrested him for the first time in 1981. He was in prison for a couple of years, and then they let him go, and then they arrested him again in 85. I think he was out of prison for something like 17 months, and then they rearrested him. Then he was in prison for about 5 years. They let him out again. And then in 91, he came to the States, and we visited and spent a year together. And then he went back in 92, where they arrested him again. Anyway, back and forth, in and out of prison. And he continued reporting. He continued defying the regime and continued speaking out against their crimes and their mafiosi type of power grab of Iran and the manipulation of the country, the gutting of the national wealth. And so he basically was rearrested. Well, and the last time it was in November of 2001. He was kidnapped from his sister's house and taken to prison, and they didn't let us know. We kind of knew, obviously, because you just don't disappear into the night in Iran and not end up in a prison. And this time they claimed that he was a combatant against God, which is execution. It's a crime execution that one is executed for. How you're a combatant against God, I don't know, but there you have it. Then they had said that he was corrupt. They claimed that he had taken money from the CIA through me in order to buy off journalists in Iran in order to get them to write negative stuff about the regime. Long story short, he spent about 7 years in prison after that, but because of the pressure that me and my family put on the regime and through the assistance and attention of various international human rights and civil rights entities, they had to let him go because he had had two major heart attacks and a third near-fatal heart attack in prison. Various other ailments, they had him in solitary confinement for 492 days, which in a one-and-a-half-meter-by-two-meter dark box where they would pour boiling hot water. He had over you know, 40% of his body had untreated second-degree burns when they got him out from, after 492 days. He was 72 the last time they took him. And so what they had done to him was enough for us to, you know, raise international hell, which we did. And so they kept him under house arrest, and he was able to get medical treatment. And every once in a while he would have visitors and friends and so on, until April 29th of 2011, the Revolutionary Guards poured into his house and into his little apartment and threw him out of the sixth floor balcony and killed him.
This is awful, just awful. And you know, Bonifay, when you are documenting what your father did, we can certainly just look and appreciate the hard work he contributed in exposing this regime. He stayed there. He reported on it. He did what every journalist does to report the truth and report the facts. Because when I look at Iran, journalists, bloggers, political prisoners are put in solitary confinement. They're accused of acting against national security. They're treated with such corrupt shame, and they're brutalized and oftentimes killed, unfortunately, like your father. As you look back to his contribution, how has this shaped your life as speaking out as a human rights person and doing all you can to expose this regime for who they are?
Well, I mean, in every way, because, you know, it sort of has defined me in how I have the choices I've made in my life. But I have to say in one thing, and that is that it is always shocking and horrifying to me that people, you know, that the heroes like Nelson Mandela and Václav Havel are identified and celebrated, and certainly deservedly so, whereas there are many Iranians, such as my father, who go unrecognized by the international media and certainly by all the bigwigs who claim to be human rights activists. When my father was in prison, I knocked on every door of every rock star, movie star, public intellectual, journalists, you know, news outlets, so on and so forth. And believe it or not, nobody helped us. Not a single person. There were two people from his old days as a Hollywood reporter and as a film historian who spoke out. One was Gregory Peck and the other one was Anthony Quinn, and they both died just several months after my father was taken, so they didn't really have the you know, the time to sort of really expose it and really fight on his behalf. But I'm ashamed that the Western world treats us like we don't exist, or like we don't need to be heard, or that that when we as law-abiding new Americans who are patriots in this country come and ask for public assistance. We don't even care if the media wants to help. We don't care if the bigwig, the politicos in D.C. want to help. We want the public's attention and assistance in exposing and in a chain reaction, passing the information on, so that we can then petition the larger bodies of, you know, entertainment, politics, et cetera, to act on our behalf. We didn't even get that. And a huge part of the so-called aware West, and I mean that across the political spectrum, it could be from the right to the left, every single person who I talked to, who I explained the situation to, the people who sort of cared, their eyes glazed over when I told them about it, and they sort of were like, oh, well. And the people who didn't care, or who are basically, you know, let's say, apologists for these horrible dictators, would say to me, oh, well, your father spoke out against the government. What do you expect? And I'm like, well, you're speaking out against your government. Why aren't you in prison? And why is it that we are no more important than the Nelson Mandelas and the Václav Havels and the Sharanskys of the world? So I am horrified at how the West has treated the issue of Iran and the millions of people that the Iranian regime inside Iran has killed, how the Iranian regime has gutted Iran, taken the Iranian people's income from the sale of our natural resources and spent it on terrorism. And every time we try to explain to people the reality of what it is to be an Iranian, either inside or outside Iran, everybody just sort of looks at me like, oh, well, it's over there, you know. We're sorry, but, you know, it has nothing to do with us. And meanwhile, every single one of my friends who I was warning back in the 80s in Chico, New York City, is now not only aware, but they, on 9-11, on 9-12, I must have received 100 phone calls of apology for having doubted my attempt at bringing awareness for the 20-some years that I was speaking up.
Well, this is really a shame because here we have freedom, Bonifshe, and this program is dedicated to speaking truth and freedom and hope to Iranians. My whole goal is to make people in the West aware, just like you, of the atrocities by this regime. And what really, really infuriates me is that we're giving Iran a four-month extension in these talks. And it's amazing that the nuclear issue is taking predecessing. It's overshadowing the real issue of human rights. My own country seems to be obsessed with this whole nuclear situation, and I know that it has some importance, but human rights are being overshadowed. We have an American pastor sitting in an Iranian prison who should be home with his family. And so I hear what you're saying, that we have a job, a responsibility to make people aware, and there should not be this cavalier attitude by the press, the media. They should be following what we're saying and standing up for what we're speaking out about.
I agree. See, the thing is that, you know, a lot of people do not understand the cultural and historical background of what these terrorists and these ideologues who abuse the nature and purpose of faith. And I'll be very honest. I'm an agnostic, but I have many, many friends who are people of faith, and I don't for one second doubt the fact that their faith is what has made them the amazing people that they are. So to me, it's my personal experience, but the experience of other people that makes them who they are, makes them, you know, exceptional human beings, is something I do not disregard or take lightly. That said, it's one thing to be, a person of faith. It's another thing to hijack religion and claim that you are acting on behalf of a prophet or a messenger of the Lord. To me, when you get to the point where you cannot possibly live and let live, and you basically abuse the heart and soul of a person's need to commune with their own creator, then that is when you have overstepped a line that definitely requires confrontation. And I do mean confrontation. Well, I mean, I believe in the one thing that I believe in a lot of the words of Jesus Christ when he talked about, you know, being, you know, sort of confronting the ill, confronting the you know, and standing up to anything and everything that basically steps on a human being's ability to exist and be the best that they can be.
Yes, in fact, Jesus always exposed the religious leaders of his time for their corruption, for the way they treated people. He would walk into the money changer's table and into
That's
the house
exactly
of prayer.
What I was thinking.
And he would confront them, and he showed his authority. But I wanted to ask you a question going back on what you said. We as Westerners want to understand how and why this regime opposes democracy and freedom, why there is no religious freedom, why Muslims who convert to Christianity are accused of acting against national security. give us a historical, maybe a little bit of a historical experience as to how this happened and why they are so opposed to our freedoms and values.
Well, look, it's old-fashioned control methods. I mean, the thing is that when you look at, many, let's say, ancient cultures and the way they were sort of treated by their leaders or their kings or whoever. This has become a sort of a pattern in that part of the world that has become really, really hard to break for the characters who are in the leadership position. And we see that, for example, in Russia and China, obviously. But the thing is that in terms of Iran, one of our serious drawbacks and problems is the fact that we have oil, and this oil has been the bane of our existence for since 1901 when it was discovered in Iran. We have been pushed and pulled, and before that it was, from the beginning of Iranian history, if you look at the various wars, and I'm sure people are, familiar with the Persian-Greek wars, then we had the Arab invasion, then we had the Mongolians coming and out. I mean, we've had our serious trials and tribulations throughout history, but the one period that to me is a particularly difficult and nightmarish time in our history, because it has gone on now for 400 years, is the Russian manipulation and messing around with Iran. Russians have been trying to take over Iran, trying to siphon our oil, trying to siphon our gas, trying to manipulate our political direction. They have had they've done every single imaginable thing they could in order to basically take over Iran, because Iran has access to warm water ports, which the Russians don't have. It has, wonderful, mines and natural resources such as uranium and copper. It has, tons of gas and oil. We're the fourth richest oil country in the world. So the thing is that, we have never been able to successfully take over take our country and manage it for the long term. Whatever successes we've had have been short terms, and Iranians being extremely brilliant and highly motivated people have basically taken what freedoms they can get for 5 minutes, and then it's been grabbed out of their hands. So in the case of 1979 and the Khomeinists, it's not something that happened in 79, in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 50s. It was going on since the late 1800s, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. And from one generation of the mullahs to the next generation, from one syndicate of mullahs to another, and various, sects and branches that were created, one more violent and racist and hateful than the other, have developed until they basically became Khomeini. And that has remained very much intact, and there's nothing that the Iranians haven't done to be rid of these people, but the fact is that as Iranians say it themselves, we are stuck with these guys until the powers that be outside of Iran want these goons to stay around. Because look, 2009, what is it that the Iranians didn't do in 2009 when Obama betrayed us? We saw Neda Agha Sultan get killed in the streets of Iran. Was there a more shocking image than the death of Neda Agha Sultan? And the Iranian people screamed and begged for Obama to help, to stand by us, and rather than stand by us, he squandered that opportunity, and then and now he's actually empowered a regime that we had been able, we had brought down on its knees, essentially.
And I think back to the 70s when Jimmy Carter was president and really had an opportunity to reach out in the Shah situation and abandon him. And we look at Jimmy Carter and Obama, they're two of the same breed, if you will. And President Obama is basically very cavalier and unattached to what's going on in the world right now. And I hear exactly what you're saying, because Neda Sultan's video is what is the reason why I do what I do, Bonifshay. I was so taken in by this video. I knew I had to do something and had to speak out, and this is the reality of what it's brought, what I'm doing today. But I wanted to just go back a little bit. I'm thinking of before Khomeini took power, you had in Iran, you had the Shah, and it was much more secular. There wasn't this blending of state politics and, you know, Islam and government as much as you have, of course, with Khomeini. And many of the mullahs were dissatisfied with the Shah because he seemed too secular and too dependent on the United States, and there was too much Western values. And as soon as Khomeini came in, women had to wear the hijab publicly again, and control took over. And this has been the reality of what happens when we don't help our Iranian friends and we let the powers that be take control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I mean, I grew up in Iran during the time of the Shah. True that, you know, the Marxist elements that were in Iran were outlawed, and it was, though the various trials of the so-called activists who were in prison for their Marxist activities was even shown on television in Iran, and yes, they were executed in the end. There were several of them, but those people, for the most part, some of them were KGB, and that was proven. And some of them were the harbingers of what is now. They were, oddly enough, they called themselves Marxist Islamics, which is kind of contradictory, because Sharia law, Sharia banking does not allow for socialism or the sharing of wealth. So Marxist Islamism is an absolute lie, and basically they were people who had been bought off emotionally, and felt that their speaking out with the various symbolic, if you will, it kind of reminded me of Hitler, because, you know, Hitler also took various images and concepts from various religions and national identities and patriotic symbols from various countries, and, you know, mishmashed them together and created his Third Reich. The Iranian regime, the Marxist Islamics did the very, very much the same thing. They took the symbol of Ali, Imam Ali, as the righteous man, and they sort of, you know, mishmashed it and mixed it in with certain Marxist ideals, and basically turned it into a fashionable thing that many Europeans and American leftists bought into as some form of liberty. Ultimately, those people were a big, giant part of the problem in Iran. Had the Shah left them to their own devices and let them run around being the kooks that they were publicly, mm-hmm. he would have probably succeeded and not been outed, not been touted, I should say, as a human rights violator. One of the interesting things is that the mullah, who during the time of Khomeini was in charge of, during the time of the revolution, in the early days of the revolution, was in charge of looking into the numbers of political prisoners there had been in Iran, which came out to like something like 1,000 plus people, in 2004 resigned his commission with the Iranian regime and angrily walked away and said, you know, I looked at the numbers, the real numbers of the political prisoners in Iran in 1979, and now here we are 26 years later, and we have killed something like, 300,000 times more people than that. By 2004, the numbers of people who, including the 900,000 young men who were killed in the 8 years of this Iran-Iraq war, was a million plus.
There is no comparison.
So basically, there you have it. An Iran that could have very easily been a superb new Middle Eastern Japan, if you will, was gutted into an archaic 7th century hole, basically, with tall buildings.
Yes. I wanted to jump on the statistic you were talking about when this man compared the number of political prisoners, the deaths compared to those imprisoned in the Shah's regime. Since Rouhani has been president of Iran, the execution rate has tripled. There are more political prisoners suffering, and he promised to do something about the Internet, lessening the stringent things on the Internet. And on women's rights, he was supposed to do something about making it easier for women in the summer to wear their hijab, to show a little bit more hair because of the excruciating heat. He made several promises to do something. And, of course, he's just the president. But I'm thinking of, since Rouhani's become president, things have gotten worse as far as political prisoners, executions. Would you agree?
Oh, yes. Look, the bottom line is that the Iranian regime tells some truths, like we're going to we're going to bomb Israel, we're going to, kill Baha'is, we're going to, take over the world. Those things are things that people should believe because they've done it, they do it, they will continue to. They've specifically said that they intend to become the Islamic pole on the planet, which means, read between the lines, we will take over and kill as many Sunnis as we need to because the Iranian regime is Shia, which means we will kill as many Sunnis as we need to in order to take control of Islam and make everybody come under the standard of the Khomeiniist Shia flag. So that said, as long as this regime is there, whatever promises they make in terms of nuclear, in terms of human rights, in terms of civil rights, in terms of anything else is a big lie. And if anybody doubts it, all they have to do is go and look through 36 years, and I'd be happy to walk them through it.
Now, actually, you are the producer of a very popular video on YouTube. It's gone viral, over a million hits on it. It's called Set the Red Line. Can you kind of just describe for us the purpose of this video, what you're trying to accomplish, and what you're saying in this video to educate us about what's going on with Iran?
I realize that Iran is a very, very complicated topic. Again, a lot of the issues, are complicated for many Iranians who are not necessarily politically involved. It's a topic that covers the grounds for, as I've just said, hundreds of decades, if not hundreds of years. What I tried to do with this video is to boil the issue of the Iranian regime's danger down to three simple factors. And those are three factors that are not only, helpful for Iranians, it's also exceedingly important to the West and to the rest of the world because it is, it is terrorist-based, it is financial-based, and it is, faith-based. So to me, those three simple things are things that people can digest and can pass on and can understand and explain to their friends. And basically what my partner and I were trying to do with this was that we wanted to get people to sort of come together to address this issue and bring awareness. I hate to use that buzzword, but that there you have it.
Yes.
The thing is that we wanted to get people to sort of coalesce with the Iranian people and to understand that this is no longer just an issue that threatens Iran or the region. This is a situation that's on the crawl, and the Iranian regime has had its finger in every single terrorist action that there has been in the last 35 years. They killed Marines in Beirut via Hezbollah. I mean, they own Hezbollah. They've now they've been funding Hamas for the last since its inception in the early 90s. They are funding aspects of the Taliban. They are involved in huge, huge manipulations of the Levant. So essentially they stand behind Assad in Syria, that's killing hundreds of thousands of Syrians. They were involved in and masterminded the bombing of the Jewish Center in Buenos Aires in 1994. They were behind the Lockerbie plane downing in Scotland in the 80s. I mean, there isn't a single terrorist action. The Khobar Towers, the USS Cole, every single terrorist action that has happened in the last 35 years on the planet that is Islam-based has the finger of the Iranian regime in it. Now, even one of the former Revolutionary Guards who defected from Iran and moved to the West was one of the people who came and testified at the 9/11 Commission, and the Iranian connection was even exposed in 9/11. So there isn't a single instance that the Iranian regime has not been involved. They just know how to cover their tracks, and they just know how to hide the blame in a very, very clever way so that nobody can actually put their finger on them.
Yes, and they are very much volatilely involved in this situation with ISIS in Iraq. As you pointed out, they had their fingerprints all over everything. Tell me, how did they cleverly manipulate the media to somehow side in with them? What are things we can watch for that we know they're somehow involved in manipulating the media?
First and foremost, there is no negotiating with the Iranian regime. So if any member of the media tells you that this regime is you know, you can talk to it, you can negotiate with them. All you need to do is respect them. All you need to do is work with them. All you need to do is none of that. That regime is a regime that treats its own people, imprisons mullahs. I mean, you and I know of, for example, one ayatollah, an extremely righteous man who has been a political prisoner in Iran under torture for the last 9 years, the Ayatollah Khamenei Burujerdi.
Yes.
He's not the only mullah. There is a special ward in Iran, in Tehran's Evin prison, for clerics who support the separation of religion and state. Many, many of the best ayatollahs who basically said that Khomeiniism is a ruse and it's a lie and it is blasphemy. Because look, in the Shia sect, the whole nature and purpose of Shia is the separation of religion and state. Sunnis have their kings as their godheads. Shias say that the children of Muhammad are the guiding spirit of religion, but that they are not allowed to be members of any political movement. So the Shia clerics, so the real Shia clerics, who are basically confronting the Khomeiniist lie, are in prison or have been very deftly poisoned or murdered. And so the fact of the matter is that the Iranian regime claims to be a Shia and uses all the Shia ruse, but isn't actually anything but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're Satan worshippers. I mean, if you want to talk about it in religious terms, that's what they are.
Yeah.
They are your average, dirty despots who live high on the hog of old-fashioned Oriental despotism.
Well, and you mentioned the way they treat mullahs, and you gave a great example there. And historically speaking, they're out of touch with what really Shias have taught about separation of kind of church and state. But another thing I see so often, Banasheh, is the way they treat animals. I'm seeing photographs on some of my friends' page that are Iranians, and the way they desecrate and treat animals is so inhumane. And I have to agree with what you just said, that they have to be Satan worshippers, the way they treat even animals.
Yeah, I mean, look, these people are you know, whatever anybody wants to say in their excuse, as their excuse. Whoever wants to give them an excuse is misguided. There is nothing that can be done with this regime, and the bottom line is that the Iranian people need to be backed in their attempt at self-determination. And believe me, there is no going to war with Iran, only because it's not only the issue of the nukes. They have themselves said, and I believe it, the numbers aren't quite right, though at this point in time, given the number of frothing terrorists and murderers that are running around, I wouldn't be surprised. The Iranian regime itself claims, and we know this for a fact, that they have trained, funded, and given operational blueprints to 40,000 suicide bombers that are deployed or deployable around the world. Because they get them Cuban passports, they get them Venezuelan passports, they get them, you know, passports from various countries that doesn't look like Iran. And and they're not all Iranian, by the way. Most of them, in fact, 3% of are Iranian. The rest are bought off Taliban stragglers, they are Hezbollah, they are, you know, Shia from Saudi Arabia, because the Shia in Saudi Arabia is all of 10%, and they hate the, you know, the Saudi regime, all that, whatever. It's another, you know, mess of sectarianism, but they have managed to buy off all kinds of politically and ideologically deranged people. They've given them money, they've given them the operational guidelines, and they have 40,000 people who are walking bombs. And
you know,
it's one thing to have the nukes, it's another thing to have 40,000 mini nukes.
Wow. Well, you present such a fascinating case, and you help us to understand the inner workings of the regime historically and practically what their goals are. And you know, Banasheh, my whole desire is to reach Iranians, to be a voice for the voiceless, and that's what you are doing too. And that's why I write books about them. That's why I do this program and have book signings. As you have presented your case so well, what practically can people do that are listening to help Iranians that are suffering under this regime? How can they best help them?
Well, that's a slightly complicated question and an even more complicated answer.
Yeah.
Because along with the fact that I would say to people, work with vetted Iranians, but then one of the horrifying things that the Iranian regime has done has to create a huge network of spies and agents who are here to brainwash people. I'm sorry to say that all of them have shown up on Jon Stewart's show, on Bill Maher's show, and those people are very well funded. They are backed by some of the worst career politicos in Washington, D.C., people who were around the Carter administration and even prior to that. And so it's very hard to basically tell the good Iranians from bad Iranians. That said, all I can say is that people read the good media. And by the good media, I mean read people like Michael Ledeen in Pajamas Media. Read people like Claudia Rosette at Forbes. Read people like Amir Tahiri, who is at the New York Post and the Times of London. Read people like Con Coughlin in the Telegraph in the UK. And I'm on Facebook. I'm always available for everybody. Certainly you are. My friend Jim Hoft at Gateway Pundit. Michelle Malkin. We all, and to people who think, okay, conservative, well, it's got nothing to do with conservative or liberal. We also have wonderful liberal politicians like Senator Menendez of New Jersey, who's working with us, who is absolutely flawless and wonderful, hits the nail on the head. But those are far and few between, unfortunately, because the types of people who are the agents and the spies and the lobbyists of the Iranian regime have managed to make a whole lot of headway in the Senate and Congress. And, for example, they've managed to, wheedle their way into the hearts of the Black Caucus, unfortunately. They have managed to wheedle their way into the hearts of some of the, truly gullible, Republicans and Democrats like Gilchrist or even the completely corrupt Bob Ney of Ohio, who later on turned out to be taking bribes from the Chinese government. So it's a kind of a catch as catch can. You really have to know who to go to in order to find the best people who have vetted the best Iranians and the news. I wish I still had my website, but I got really exhausted by the fact that it was a daily grind, and none of us get funding. None of us have any financial support. So to be able to keep this stuff up is really difficult. Whereas the bad guys get the most amazing funding and have major fiscal support. One of those bad guys is the National Iranian American Council. They pass themselves off as these incredible, thoughtful people, but they're actually a well-known and disreputable lobby for the Iranian regime. The young man who runs it, called Trita Parsi, wears Hugo Boss suits, and he shows up on Bill Maher's show and on Jon Stewart's show. There's another guy called Reza Aslan, who claims to be some kind of a religious historian and theological philosopher, et cetera, thinks of himself as the second coming of Joseph Campbell. And yet these people are all people who have been on American TV and have passed themselves off as these incredibly thoughtful individuals, and basically what they're doing is, in fact, acting on behalf of the Iranian regime. And I know it sounds very far-fetched, but there you have it. In the case of the Iranian regime, the truth is always stranger than fiction.
Well, I really appreciate you educating us, Banafsheh, because we need to know these things. I think I speak for a lot of my friends. We care about the Iranian people. They find it really amazing that Americans love them and care for them, but we also have to beware of the false prophets, if you will, and those that are masquerading and are infiltrating our media. And thank you for educating us today, taking us on a historical journey, and sharing your heart and passion. I really appreciate your insights. I know I've learned a lot. I have a lot to learn, but I thank you so much for being my guest on The Cross in the Desert and educating us and taking the time, okay?
My pleasure. Anytime.
And I hope you come. Banafsheh, you're always welcome to come on. Thank you for your spending your time and sharing with us your knowledge.
Thank you very much, dear Randy. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. That's Manav Shahzand, and she is an expert on Iranian history and terrorism. She's been a consultant to foreign affairs departments, and she was at one time the editor of Iran Press News, and she's appeared on many programs, and you can tell she has a wealth of knowledge and understanding about the subject of Iran, which can be very, very complicated, and I so appreciate her taking the time to spend with us today and really educating us. And as I think about Iran, I think about my dear friend Saeed Abedini, who's sitting in prison in Iran, desperately wanting to come home and be reunited with his wife, Negma, and his two children, Rebecca and Jacob. And just a couple of days ago, just right after I had Negma on the broadcast on Monday, there was a video I wasn't aware of, a video made by Rebecca and Jacob as a message to our president, and it just broke me into tears. It's so beautiful, and I want to share that with you right now on The Cross in the Desert. I want you to hear this video.
Dear President Obama, please help bring my daddy home. I miss him so much. I want my daddy to bring me to Disneyland for my birthday. I don't want to miss another birthday without him. I don't want him to miss another birthday or Christmas or Father's Day. Please help bring him home. Why does our daddy need to be in prison for loving Jesus? My heart cries because it misses daddy, and when it's sleeping, it cries. And misses daddy a lot, a thousand lot. And it doesn't stop crying, and it's crying right now.
Where is it crying? How do you know it's crying?
Because I feel it.
Oh. Your heart is crying?
Yeah.
Oh.
I pray that I'll come back home, but he's still not back home.
Well, there you have it from the heart of Rebecca and Jacob. And I also understand that they made a specific video in Farsi that we can actually share on some of the Facebook pages of Rouhani. What can you say? It's hard to put into words. And these are two young children that haven't seen their daddy in more than 2 years. Broken inside, they're trying to comprehend really what's going on, and trying to put their understanding out there for us. They're trying to say something, but their human heart is just simply saying this: please bring our daddy home. And how you respond to this is you share this video with as many people in the world as you can. And we're hoping our own president will take the time and be moved by what they said, and make Saeed Abedini and Amir Hakmati his priority. That instead of nuclear rights, it's human rights. It's saying something to Iran. It's getting in their face. It's saying we're not going to move forward with any more negotiations until you let our American citizens come back home. You know, that sounds very simple. I understand being in the political world, there are different ways to handle situations, and we as citizens are trying to understand why he has not been a priority. And it's hard for us sitting back and watching and saying, look, why can't you just simply say, we're not going to talk about nuclear issues, we're going to deal with the lives of two of our American citizens, and until they are returned, we won't talk about anything else. And you and I feel that way. We look at that situation and say, why can't it be done that way? And we're given a convenient explanation as to why not. And it's heartbreaking. I know I had Negma on the program Monday, and she's going to have a special prayer visual once again this year for Saeed, her husband. And do you know that over 200 cities plus have already signed up? And so she's enduring this trial with her faith, being strong. She's committed to speaking out for not only Saeed, but for all prisoners that are under persecution, that are broken and away from their families. I know she speaks not just for her husband, but for many, many more. And as you heard Banafshe talking about the way Iran treats their prisoners, it's heart-wrenching. It's heartbreaking. And the way that her father was captured, kidnapped in prison, and then finally killed, it's heartbreaking to sit back and to be able to face this reality every day, that this regime has stolen our life, has killed our loved ones. It's hard. It's difficult to imagine how to go on and how to face the day. And so I just ask that you come to my Facebook page and share this video worldwide. It's a beautiful little video. It touches my heartstrings. When children speak, they have a way of touching your heartstrings. My latest blog was about a young 4-year-old girl, Mohana Ahmadi, who drew a picture of her father as she visualized him being hung as a Sunni. She drew a picture of him hanging. There was a picture of her standing with her mother there watching her father be hanged. What a beautiful, beautiful picture, but heart-wrenching to see what she was enduring. And do you know what? I believe that picture touched the heart of our God, because her father, Hamed, and the other 3 Sunni clerics have been removed from death row. Yes, they're still prisoners. Yes, they're still suffering, but at least he's still alive. So what I'm saying is, she drew that picture. It touched many, many hearts. And I know the video by Rebecca and Jacob is equally touching many, many hearts. I think when children speak in drawing, in making videos, whatever they do, and they have a way of reaching into the hearts. I hope this video reaches in to the deepest part of the heart of our president to make Saeed and Amir and many others his priority, to do everything he can to confront Iran to release them. And as we make this video and we put it out there, we also pray. We also pray as well that soon they will be reunited with their families. Right before Banafshe came on, I was reading to you from Psalm 46. I want to close from that. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble as its swelling. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Run to him today. He can be your refuge and strength, and you can find comfort and peace in the midst of this chaotic world when you run to him. I really want to thank Banafshe Zan once again for her expert knowledge and sharing and educating with us. I want to thank you for spending time with me today on the Cross in the Desert. This has been my vacation week, and I've really, really had a great time connecting with you and spending time with you. I hope that you've enjoyed today. As always, come to my Facebook page. You can friend request me. You're going to see many, many postings about the situation in Iran, and I hope that you will become a voice for them as well, too, to speak out and pray for them. I want to say God bless you. Thank you for joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. I will see you next Monday for the next Cross in the Desert. Have an incredible week. God bless you. Goodbye.
Healing rain is coming down, is coming nearer to this old town, rich and poor, weak and strong. It's bringing mercy, it won't be long. He
day.